my fellow historians. Welcome to a bonus episode, another episode of Where Are They Now? This time, Tyrion's trials and travails, yeah, pun intended, in the Eyrie and surrounding areas. What we did with our first Where Are They Now episode is what we're doing with this one. Waiting for a moment along our reread where lots of characters come together in one place, a lot of minor characters, and we try to take a look at where they are now because it's easy to forget where some of these characters are. And I know you don't need to be reminded that Lysa was shoved out the moon door, that Catelyn is now Lady Stoneheart with the Brotherhood, and that Sir Roderick was killed by Theon. But the other characters here, for the most part, maybe you aren't quite up to date on where they're at. So that's what we're going to take care of today. With me, as always, is Ashea, and I hope you enjoy this patrons-only episode. Starting off, Brendan Blackfish. Now, we did a whole episode on Blackfish, so I highly recommend checking that out. But just for a quick rundown, and in case you haven't seen that episode in a while, or at all, well, he doesn't make a pointless last stand at River Run like he does in the TV show. He escaped thanks to Edmure, and, well, the prevailing theory, one I agree with, is he's most likely to hook up with the Brotherhood without banners. There are clearly other possibilities, but this is the one I think that is most likely. We'll surely find out soon enough. George R. Martin has hinted that Jane Westerling will appear in the Winds of Winter prologue, and that could be where Blackfish turns back up. Just imagine the Brotherhood with Blackfish leading them in terms of military, helping them spring ambushes and things like that. This is the exact thing he was amazing at when he was helping Robb in his Riverlands campaign and Westerlands campaigns. But what about when Blackfish actually meets Lady Stoneheart? Now that, who knows what's going to happen there? That is really, well, we'll have to wait and see if we get that one on the page, either through Brienne or Jaime's point of view. Next up is Bronn. That's another one you guys might remember without needing to be reminded. However, Bronn on TV and Bronn in the books are fairly different in terms of outcome. Well, maybe, probably, I'd say. Now, just imagine if Jaime hadn't come along on TV and told Bronn, nah, you don't get this woman in this castle. That's basically where Book Bronn is, if that TV scene hadn't happened. And it was Castle Stokeworth, which is where Bronn is now. Book Lady Stokeworth is Lawless, a traumatized woman who didn't seem to have all her faculties in the first place, meaning before her trauma. She has a bastard child that Bronn names Tyrion, which helps fuel Cersei's paranoia, and Cersei tries to have Bronn killed, but it backfires. It actually, not only is he not killed, but he rises higher. He's now calling himself Lord Stokeworth, and technically he appears to be correct. Again, thanks to Cersei, since she has Lawless's elder sister, Felice, killed after this failure to take out Bronn. So she basically killed the only person in front of Bronn's wife. Now Bronn's wife, who is called Lolly Slackwit, is now in charge. So Castle Stokeworth is important. It supplied about half the food to King's Landing during the War of Five Kings. The other half came mostly via Rosby, a.k.a. Giles Rosby, the coffer that Cersei appointed Master of Coin, only to have him die not long after. So Castle Stokeworth's proximity to King's Landing means it's very likely to be important. Bronn and Lollys would be called to kneel to any new person to sit on the Iron Throne, whether it be young Griff or Daenerys, or who knows, whether, after Tommen is killed, assuming that happens. Well, there's lots of possibilities here. Either way, it seems like Tyrion and Bronn's past relationship will matter. I mean, he's holding an important castle. If Tyrion is eventually going to be handed the king for the Dragon Queen so close to King's Landing, well, maybe Bronn will end up right back on Tyrion's side, but maybe not. Maybe he'll fight for young Griff. We'll have to see. Now, actual members of the Vale, or Vale families, rather. Lord Nestor Royce, at the moment we see him, he's not yet a lord. He's Sir Nestor Royce. He's from the lesser branch of House Royce, and for almost 15 years, he had been the High Steward of the Vale, as well as the Keeper of the Gates of the Moon. The Gates of the Moon was formerly the Arryn Winter Quarters. As we know, they abandon the Eyrie when it gets too cold, and this is where they hang out, the Gates of the Moon. But Littlefinger, as in his position as High Steward, Lord Protector of the Vale, gives it to Nestor's branch permanently in order to win him as an ally. In other words, it becomes a hereditary seat of this cadet branch of House Royce. However, there's a technicality, and Littlefinger is sure to make sure Nestor Royce knows about this technicality. The technicality is that the signature naming Nestor Royce Lord of the Gates of the Moon is Littlefinger's signature. Thus, it is not Lysa's nor Robert Aaron's. So if Littlefinger goes down, very likely he loses that new seat that he just got. So it's safe to say he will be a serious supporter of Littlefinger unless someone else can assure him that he doesn't lose his new lordship. In that case, he would abandon Littlefinger in a second. All he cares about is keeping that title, most likely. Interestingly enough, he's also father of Albar and Miranda Royce. Now, Miranda is set to be an interesting character. Elaine has some interesting interactions with her in her Winds of Winter chapter. But she's not actually present here. Albar Royce, however, is. And Albar is the eldest son, possibly only son of Nestor. We think he may have a second son. It's not clear. And he's a grown man, but unmarried, as far as we know. He was one of the men who offered to fight for Lysa in Tyrion's trial. He's probably going to back his father and Littlefinger now that he's the heir to the Gates of the Moon. And, well, the fact that he's unmarried is probably going to change. One of the reasons he's unmarried is probably because, well, they didn't have lands to pass on. He wasn't going to inherit any lands, being from a landless cadet branch of House Royce. But now they do have lands, and he's going to inherit them, so he's going to want to get an heir. That could be an interesting little miniature political development later. Probably won't be Elaine who marries him, but she does dance with him in the Winds of Winter chapter I just mentioned. Sir Lynn Corbray, a very dangerous man, super confident, wielder of a Valyrian steel blade, Lady Forlorn. He's certainly gay, and if Littlefinger's comment that he likes boys is literal, then he's right there with the TV version of Meryn Trant, meaning a pedophile. Yet another agent of Littlefinger. He's the one that helps Mr. Baelish. Mr., not Lord. I call him Mr. Baelish. He disrupts the meeting with the Lord's declarant. It's a perfect example of the rigidity of honor exploited so easily, kind of like the way Bronn does, but in a political way instead of in combat. But openly, he claims to hate Littlefinger. He acts against him and does all these things that seem to be against Littlefinger. But Littlefinger explains to Sansa, this is part of the act. He's being paid to do this. And part of the reason this lie works so well is Lynn's brother Lionel is mad that their dad gave Lynn Lady Forlorn, even though Lionel got the seat and all the title and all the other good stuff that comes with being the eldest born Corbray. Lionel is an open ally of Littlefinger, so having them on opposite sides, well, it works. Well, apparently. To this point, it has seemingly worked because the two seem to have a real dispute that keeps them on opposite sides. And again, honor and pride are a major factor. The Vale Lords don't like Lionel's marriage, which is something Lynn can complain about too with them, because it was to a rich merchant's daughter instead of to a daughter of the nobility. The shame, right? But in the Vale, that matters even more than in these other stodgy noble houses. They're worse than the Stormlands and the Reach, most likely, as far as we can tell. Until recently, Lynn Corbray had Michael Redfort as his squire, and Michael was the one Mia Stone thought would marry her, but Catelyn guessed correctly that that would not happen. He's preparing to fight in the Tourney of the Winged Knights, which are it's a tournament that's going to pick 8 protectors to guard Robert Aaron, and given his skill, he's a favorite to be one of the 8. Now, given that Robert Aaron is so likely to die, that means he won't be guarding Robert Aaron very long. So maybe he's one of the ones that goes north to Winterfell with so many of these other knights, assuming we get something like that in the books, as we saw in the show. Next up is Lord Eon Hunter. He is one of the ones that doesn't make it. He dies suddenly in a storm of swords. And Littlefinger thinks it was his third son, Harlan.
He did not, in fact, live for eons.
But he did rule for 60 years, which is pretty long, or almost 60 years, which is pretty darn long. That's almost like an eon, right?
Yeah, almost.
Ned actually remembers him from the tournament in Harrenhal. He was friendly with Robert Baratheon and Jon Arryn back then. Now, Littlefinger thinks his third son, Harland, is responsible for killing him, and he thinks that the new lord, Gilwood, will also be killed either by Harlan or Harlan's elder brother, the second son, Eustace. And because of all this chaos, Littlefinger is not terribly concerned with them opposing him because, well, they can't get their act together. But if Lord Harlan Hunter becomes, well, if he becomes Lord Harlan Hunter by killing his brothers, then they may have stability and then they may be important politically again, something that Littlefinger will have to pay attention to. And others. Of lesser rank, here is Sir Willis Wode. He's one of the few to make it through with Catelyn and Sir Roderick and Bronn and attends the trial as well. He's one of the ones that laughs. Well, almost everyone laughs, really. Even Bronn. Jaime passes by Willis Wode's lands in Feast for Crows, and they are devastated. He has two timber keeps, and they're both torched. There's outlaws hanging out there, and Jaime makes them hang out even more. Yeah, that was a pun. He hangs them. And the Wodes are sworn... Swode? I almost said Swode. I did say Swode. The Wodes are sworn to Harrenhal, and that maybe is going to be relevant. We're not even sure if Willis is still alive. He could still be in the Vale.
Right there, you said relevant.
Relevant? Did I
like
really?
That's awesome. Relevant Elephant.
That's a new band name, Relevant Elephant. So Willis could still be in the Vale, in which case we'll see him probably at the tourney for the Winged Knights. He may even compete in it. If he already tried to go back to his lands, which is possible, then it doesn't look like he made it since Jaime found a bunch of outlaws hanging out there. So we're not sure. Marillion. Tortured and maimed and having falsely confessed to the murder of Lysa, has his eyes taken out. He just sings constantly. Littlefinger tells Sansa that Marillion has at last given into the blue and jumped. Sansa tells this to Sweet Robin, but oddly, Sweet Robin claims he can still hear him singing at night, which maybe he's dreaming. It's kind of an odd line, but we can be very sure Marillion is dead. They abandoned the Eyrie to Winter, and we see Mord show up at the Gates of the Moon, and he didn't bring any prisoners with him as far as we can see, so it looks like Marillion either already jumped or was left up there, which really makes you think, doesn't it? Is that normally what happens to prisoners in the Sky Cell? They only end up in there for a few months because then they get left there in winter, and who's going to feed them if they're just stuck up there? So, more people may jump out of the Sky Cells than we realize. And Mord, of course, speaking of him, he now has gold teeth. Otherwise, he's no closer to becoming Lord Mord. And he would be even worse than Bronn as a lord, probably. We'll have to see what happens to him. We can still hope he comes to collect his, quote, reward from Tyrion, which will not be a reward at all. House Linderly is mentioned. I thought it was House Viperyn. There was a young knight with green vipers on his shield and surcoat that volunteers to be Lysa's champion. But that's not House Viperyn. House Viperyn's sigil is a small frog. Linderly. House Linderly has these green serpents, and they are also allied to Littlefinger. So it's like everyone we're naming has been scooped up by Littlefinger as an ally. And some who were eventually scooped up by Littlefinger were opposed to him at first. So we know of two young Linderlys that this knight could have been. Terence Linderly, who is a squire to Robert Arryn, yet another ally to Littlefinger, who is very close to the High Lord here. And Lyman Linderly, who Sansa overhears talking about how Robert Arryn hates singers, which implies he has some knowledge of him, meaning he was not unlikely to have been in the Eyrie during all this time, which means he may have been the one. Terence, however, is the heir to House Linderly, so he's maybe more important. Next up is Sir Morton Wainwood. Morton Wainwood is the guy who gave us the quote regarding knights and sellswords. In other words, the one who thought Bronn was a coward, even though he quite bravely stood up to fight in this trial by combat. Morton is Anya Wainwood's heir, and the Wainwoods rule Castle Iron Oaks, and Anya was there on TV with Jon Royce in those Vale scenes when they're accusing Littlefinger and Sansa's doing her thing. Note that Anya was the ward of Harold Harding, a.k.a. the one Littlefinger is trying to get Sansa to marry and to claim the Vale and all that.
She's not the ward of him. Like, she is, warding him, to be clear. She's quite elderly in comparison to him.
Right, he's the ward.
Yes.
Sorry. She's in charge, he's the ward, not the other way around. But she basically was opposed to Littlefinger, but then was purchased. Basically, she was bought. Littlefinger purchased her Harding's hand in marriage for Elaine by buying up all of the Wainwood's debts and then agreeing to forgive those debts in exchange for this arrangement. Again, Littlefinger making moves. Now, how about Sweet Robin himself? The great glow-up of Lord Robert Aaron on TV is not very likely to happen. This one is a lot more likely to die well before that point. Littlefinger expects him to die and is giving him sweet sleep, which it could kill him, will kill him if it's given to him too much. So
yeah, that seems extremely likely.
Yeah, poor Sweet Robin is done. It just hasn't happened yet. And Maester Coleman, the person who is dosing him with sweet sleep, points out that after the two doses they give him during the descent, in other words, to keep him steady during the terrifying descent from the Eyrie, they gave him two doses. Maester Coleman is against that and says, but it happens. And then says they shouldn't give him sweet sleep again for like half a year. Does anyone think that's actually going to happen? So my note here is, welp. Yep, he's doomed. Very doomed. Now, interestingly, Maester Coleman is the man that was successfully saving John Aaron before Pycelle stepped in to stop him from saving John Aaron. I.e., Coleman has some skills here with poisoning and knows what's going on a bit.
And he wasn't sold, but, you know, Littlefinger didn't have him wrapped around his little finger at that point.
That's true. And there's an interesting note here I added that Catelyn notices that he seems nervous. He's drinking at the trial by combat. Like, it makes him nervous. Like, he's afraid to see a little bit of violence done, even though it has nothing to do with him. Which means poisoning little Robert Aaron on purpose, he might not have the stomach to do that, which means Littlefinger might have to, you know, push him along or get him out of the way to find a maester that will do it. So it could be a small hiccup for Littlefinger, but I doubt this nervous maester will be too much of an impediment.
I was wondering, you know, if Coleman really didn't have the stomach for it, he's the one who can, you know, controls communication. He could send out, you know, a letter saying
that's true. I don't know if he's brave enough to do that,
exactly,
but you're right.
That's my
he
point.
Has that
it
option.
Could, it could speak to his cowardice.
It's a good call, though. I hadn't thought of that possibility. So that's it for the people in the nobles in the Vale who watched the trial. But as we said, this is his trials and travails, which means we're talking about the next scene as well when he encounters a bunch of the Vale clansmen. Not that many of them are named, and we may have another batch of these later when we get more Vale clansmen named. We only get five of them named here. Gunthor, Shaga, Jagot, Khan, and Torek.
Excuse me, yeah, Jago.
Jago is the appropriate way to say it. Now, Jago and Torek. Now, you got me saying Eyrie the other day, and now you got me saying Jago. Now, Jagot and Torek don't appear again. We don't know what happened to them. Gunthor, son of Gurn, is, of course, a stone crow. Of course, he's a stone crow.
Not
right?
Son of Gurm.
Not son of Gurm, but closely son of Gurm. He survives the battles and leads his now well-armed fellows on raids. Arya and Sandor hear of him much later that he and his men have wiped out an entire village, essentially, kind of near the border of the Riverlands and the Vale. So he's still out there doing his thing, and we may hear of him yet again, leading his men. His band of warriors is probably larger given the success, as I said, in Valar Aredis Episode 7, raiding cultures reward successful raiding leaders. And Gunthor apparently is very successful. Shaga, son of Dolph, fights with Tyrion at the Green Fork with his two axes, or three axes, really, and raids Stannis in the Kingwood afterwards, in the Kingswood, rather. He is part of the scouting group, or the anti-scouting group, that cuts down Stannis's foragers and scouts in advance of the Battle of Blackwater to help prevent them from knowing what's up. And it has more a better effect than they even knew it would have, because Tyrion didn't plan on his father attacking Stannis in the rear, but probably Shaga helped with that by all his raiding in the Kingswood. It's funny to recall that Tyrion tells Shaga what to do, and Shaga puts his hand on Tyrion's head or shoulder and is like, okay, dude, look, I grew up in a raiding culture. I know how to do this. You don't have to tell me how to raid. And as far as we know, he's still there. Shaga stays in the Kingswood. He likes it better than the Vale. It's warmer there, I suppose. Maybe the food's better. That's a good choice, because the Vale's, you know, getting hit by winter, and the Kingswood not yet, at least if ever. So we'll have to wait and hopefully find out what happens to Shaga, son of Dolph, some other time. But it's cool to know he's still out there, because he's kind of a fun character. You know, he's humorous. He tells good jokes. And yeah, so we hope he turns back up. Now, poor Khan, friend of Shaga, dies during the Battle of Green Fork, gets speared in the heart, and yep, that's it for him. And that's it for us. That's all the characters we had to talk about today. We hope you enjoyed this little bonus episode. Thanks to Ashea for production and adding a few comments. Thanks to all of y'all for being Patreon supporters. Again, this is a patrons-only episode, part of our Valar Reredus extravaganza that we're running through. And we will be doing more of these when the material comes by. So until next time, you know what to do, folks. Valar Reredus.